Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, September 24th, 2006, and this is show number 62. Last week, I reviewed a little application called Drag and Drop, which is a freeware application that allows you to store folders in little tabs along the bottom of the screen in OS X. The nice thing is they pop up delightfully when you click on them, so you have easy access to those folders. I wrote to the developer, David Adamson, and asked him if it would be possible to have applications live down there as tabs, and he wrote back with this response. Applications as tabs? Like an applications windows that could minimize to tabs? The way to do that involved hacking the core frameworks a la Ape Enhancer and thus hacksy predecessors like Unsanity's Window Shade X. That's the road I started on with Drag and Drop long time ago and deemed it too unstable and intrusive for my purposes. Perhaps I'll look into it again. Well, I wrote back to David and I told him not to bother. The more I think about it is I really should be using the hide feature in OS X to get my applications out of the way and then have them just slip into the dock and then I can bring them back out. I'm not sure I don't use that more often. In any case, I wanted to tell you about the Exchange because it again illustrates the accessibility we have to shareware and freeware developers. It's just so great to get such a quick response compared to talking to a commercial vendor anyway. 2 weeks ago, I reviewed a shareware application for the Mac called iClip, and this week, listener Tim comes up with an interesting and related option. Tim writes, "Catching up on your 910 NoSilicast, I wanted to let you know, in case you didn't know, that a free iClip Lite widget exists that is very convenient, though surely not as functional as the full iClip application you reviewed. I have found it very convenient, plus it has better eye candy than the image you included in your program notes. Tim even included a nice screen snapshot, so I threw that in the show notes. I checked out iClip Lite, and it looks like it has some of the good functionality of iClip, but moved into a widget instead of a sidebar. The good news is that it's free from inventive.us/iClip Lite. The C is capitalized in iClip Lite, by the way. And if you like widgets, you'll probably find this one very useful. Just like iClip, it allows you to toss a snippet phrase, a URL, or even a file name into what I'm going to call a bucket. It sort of looks like a hole or an iris. It's a very strange little thing, but I'm going to call them buckets. And then you can retrieve those little snippets or URLs or files later. You have to play with this a bit to see why it's useful. The eye candy to which Tim refers are a series of black circles that wink open when you click on the in arrow to put something in it. You don't need to paste from the clipboard. To copy something out of it and into the clipboard, you simply click on the out arrow. To delete what's in the bucket, just click on the international symbol for do not enter. Tim points out that the black tab on the right permits you to stretch or shrink the widget to your space constraints, showing as many buckets as you have width for on the screen. I have come to depend on iClip for one very special use, and that's the URL of the current week's podcast. I have to enter that over and over and over again to make the images come up in the show notes, but each week, the end of it is different for the folder I make for the current week. For this reason, iClip beats iClip Lite because I can edit what's in the bucket and just change the end of it. While in iClip Lite, it's pretty much put in there or delete it. You can't really edit it that I can see. Oh well, it's free at least. iClip Lite does beat iClip in being a widget because I think widgets behave more consistently than things that pull out from the side of the window. As I mentioned a few weeks back, switching to an external monitor makes those applications behave kind of hinky. Sometimes I have to force iClip open by pushing the little button they put in the menu bar. It won't come up when I drag my mouse to the side, but other times it comes up just fine. Widgets seem to work everywhere and all the time. I've also noticed that widgets are, their speed of coming up is very dependent on how often you ask for them. If you're clicking on your widgets pretty frequently, they're really, really handy. But if you wait a couple of days to click one, man, they just take forever to load. So now that I'm using them more, I think I see why people like them. The iClip Lite website says it can even be a handy file launcher. Simply copy a file in the Finder and paste it into a bin. I guess that's what I'm calling buckets. then double-click to launch. I tested it, and it worked as advertised, but the icon that was in that bin did nothing to tell me what file was in it. So if you had a bunch of Word files stored there for easy launching, you'd never be able to tell which one was which. Maybe I missed it, but I couldn't find a place to tell them apart. In any case, this is a useful little widget that could make your life easier. So check it out at inventive.us/iClipLite. Last week, I talked about a delightful little number that has some fascinating characteristics. The number is 142857. I went on and on about it last week, so go read it listen to it if you want to hear it again. But listener Maurice from the Netherlands sent in a new fact about 142857 that I hadn't learned about yet. This one may be better to read in the show notes, but let me give it a try. He says, "Hi, Allison. Another funny property of 1/7th. That's 142857. 1/7th is the sum of 0.14 plus 0.0028 plus 0.000056 plus 0.00000112. Anyway, as you can watch the pattern, it's 0.14, 0.28, 0.56, 0.112, and it keeps going. I guess it's not a decimal point on each one of those, but you get what I mean. The end of each of these numbers is doubling each time. As he says, each term is 1/50th of the previous term. Well, Maurice, I'm not sure that everyone gets that math and numbers can be beautiful, but I'm glad you enjoy the elegance of this one, too. Thanks for the extra info on this one. Well, poor QA Director Steve has been bereft lately, as he hasn't been able to find any mistakes in the podcast, but it looks like he found one last week. When I was talking about that cool number, I explained that when you multiplied it by 14, the number changed so that it was all 9s except the first and last digit, which added to 9. The problem is that I evidently did not read the number correctly. I think I said the number was 999-9998 instead of 1-999-998. That might even be too many nines. I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure only Steve and I are really following at this point. But I am afraid that many of you may have been lying awake at night worried about how this actually worked, so I am glad that QA Director Steve is there to correct these critical errors. Thanks, Steve. I was telling listener Art about how hard Flash animations crank up my processors on the Intel-based Macintoshes, which I've mentioned here in the podcast. And he told me about a great extension for Firefox that gives you the choice of whether to play Flash inside websites. So, for example, go to a site like MySpace and check how much your processor gets hosed up. Wouldn't it be nice if you could play only the Flash files that you want to play? For instance, if you go to YouTube, you probably want to play Flash videos. But if you go to MySpace, do you really care if the dancing emoticons in the ad banner are actually dancing for you? Check out the extension for Firefox called FlashBlock from flashblock.mozdev.org. In Firefox, go to the menu bar and select Tools and pull down to Extensions. In the list that comes up, yours might be empty unless you're crazy like me and have a whole bunch of them in there, but at the bottom of it, you have a spot where you can click on Get More Extensions. This will take you to the Firefox Extensions website, and from there you can search on FlashBlock. If you select the download, all you have to do is restart Firefox and you'll have the extension all ready to go. So go to a website like YouTube after you do the installation, and instead of the Flash videos being there, you'll see a script F that looks like the F in Flash. The best part is that if you click on the F, the video starts to play right away. This is kind of the best of both worlds. You can play Flash when you want to, but it's your choice. Thanks, Art, for a great enhancement to my surfing experience. That's going to come in really handy. So have you ever been watching a video, maybe of a podcast, and you wish you could jog down a note to remind yourself of something they said, maybe even to bookmark that note to a specific time in the video so you could come back and rewatch it? If so, you might want to check out QT Movie Note Taker from dvcreators.net, which works on both OS X and Windows XP. I downloaded QT Movie and gave it a whirl. I found that it worked with .m4v files and .mov files, but not with AVIs. The first thing you do is click on Load Movie, and the movie launches on the right-hand side, while over on the left is a field where your notes will go. One button says to start the movie, and after the movie starts, it changes to stop movie and take a note. As soon as you tell it to stop, a timestamp is placed in the note field, and your cursor is ready to type in a note. Click the button again, and the movie plays again. Once you've created these notes with their timestamps, you can click on any of the timestamps, and the movie jumps right to that position. You can even create a recurring note, which I can see could be very useful. You can save your notes as a simple text file, or you can email the notes to someone where the notes with their timestamps are in the body of the email. One thing to keep an eye on is that at rest, Qt Movie Maker sucks up system resources like crazy. At idle, it was taking up 40% of my available processor power. I know not everybody watches their processors as intensely as I do, but it kind of helps, I think, to let you know if your system's slowing down and you have something like that in the background, or maybe you've hidden the application and you wouldn't know why your system was so slow. Qt Movie Maker is a simple tool that provides a really specific capability. And that's the great thing about freeware and shareware. It does what it does perfectly, and it isn't a big pile of bloatware doing all kinds of fancy tricks that just slow it down. A few shows back, I talked about how sometimes we're afraid to do something that everyone else seems to know how to do. So I did a tutorial on how to put a video up on YouTube in case any of you were just needed that little nudge to get started. I also in that show mentioned that I'm afraid to sell anything on eBay because everybody else seems to know how to do it but me. Well, listener Margaret decided it was time she helps me out and wrote a tutorial just for the show. She included 18 screenshots to help you walk through the menus, so when you're done listening to this show and you want to take a shot at eBay yourself, check out the show notes for the full tutorial. I'll also be adding it to the list of permanent tutorials in the right-hand sidebar on podfeet.com. Margaret wanted me to point out that there are now two ways of doing listings on eBay, and her tutorial is on the original method. You might prefer the new method, but this is the one she likes. Listen in as we all learn how to sell on eBay using Margaret's great tutorial. In order to buy and sell on eBay, you'll need to have a username. To create a username, click on Register at the top of any screen on eBay.com. Registering is easy. You fill in personal information such as name and address, etc. You'll also need to create a password and provide a valid email address. Once completed, you will receive an email from eBay to which you must respond in order to continue. It's that easy to get started. You do not need a PayPal account in order to sell or buy on eBay, but it's strongly recommended. Most buyers prefer PayPal as it does not cost them any money, although as a seller you must pay a small user fee based on transaction amount or time to pay. One click and they've already paid. I know a lot of eBayers who do not bid on an item if PayPal is not an option. So to create a PayPal account, go to paypal.com and click on Sign Up. Again, you will fill in personal information, create a password, and provide valid email addresses and bank account number. PayPal will deduct one or two small amounts from your account to confirm that the bank link is working. I'm assuming she means those are pennies, I sure hope so. Once that's confirmed, you'll now have a PayPal account. Let me interrupt the tutorial for just a minute here. Make sure that you never, ever, 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 ever click on a PayPal link in an email. Those are all fake, every one of them. I don't think there's ever been a real PayPal email. So don't ever go there and put in your account information because those are the fake ones. But if you go to a browser and you type in http://www.paypal.com, you'll be safe. Enough with the commercial, back to the tutorial. From the top of any eBay screen, click Sell. Then click Sell Your Item. If you're not already logged into eBay, you'll be asked for your user ID and password. You now have three auction choices. The most common choice is Sell Item at Online Auction. Check this box and continue. We'll now go through the five steps to list your item. You're now at step one, choosing a main category for your item. For example, we are selling the DVD in our Breaking Away. So I chose category DVD and Movies, and then I hit Continue. If you have trouble figuring out a category for your item, enter item keywords to see if eBay can direct you. There's also a chance to add a second main category. This option costs extra and in most cases is not necessary. Now I have narrowed my category down so I can continue or add more features to my listing. Every screen has the chance to add features and costs to your listing. eBay warns you so you aren't surprised by the additional costs. Also, at every step, you can click a Learn More, Fees, or Tip button for additional information. I always choose the path that doesn't cost extra. We are now at step 2, Title and Description. Since I'm selling a DVD, eBay will let me enter a UPC code that will enter all sorts of preloaded information about this DVD. This is a great new feature. I, however, will go the old-fashioned way and create my own description and, quote, list the standard way, unquote. I now must title my listing in 55 characters or less. Try to be as descriptive as possible so that your item will show up in searches. Better descriptions equals better exposure. Time to describe your item. Again, you will notice that there are tips you can click on for help. Step 3, pictures and details. Time to add pictures to showcase your item and come up with a starting bid. Note the prompt to help you decide on a starting price. The higher the starting price, the more eBay charges for insertion fees. For a list of fees, go to the fee screen. I always start at $9.99 or less. Determine your auction length and start time. Note selecting a start time costs extra, but might be worth it. Often you don't have you have time to list items, but then realize you won't be around when the auction actually ends. Selecting a start time for later in the week might be helpful. Time to add photos. The first photo is free. Each additional costs more unless you load from your own FTP space. Loading from your own FTP space is free. Just click on your web hosting tab to fill in the URL. Note, keep photos less than 500 pixels wide with about a 50K file size. If you don't want to deal with FTP, then just click on eBay Basic Picture Service and load photos there. Note that for an additional charge, you can gussy up your listing with all kinds of borders, backgrounds, and other features. Frankly, I find that annoying. It is a good idea to have a gallery photo if you're selling an item that might benefit from a thumbnail view with the title description. I've decided that Breaking Away DVD does not need this. Even more ways to promote your product. Again, I decline, although I do like the free counter. Step 4, payment and shipping. Choose your payment options here. You also choose your shipping methods. I ship anywhere. I chose the flat rate tab as I like to give a flat rate shipping price. For the US, I like priority shipping because the post office provides you with free boxes and tape. To find other shipping boxes, dumpster dive over at Cost Plus or other non-food stores. Wealthy neighborhoods at Christmas time are a great place to get shipping supplies. eBay has partnered with the US Postal Service, so you should be able to review rates right at this screen. You can also go to USPS.gov and download the latest rate schedule. Of course, you can also choose to ship FedEx or UPS as well. Look, more helpful shipping prompts come up. I like to give insurance as an option, so I check that box. Note that a lot of fields you can just leave blank if they don't pertain to you. You can also add a return policy note or additional shipping note. I chose to let my international friends know that their shipping will cost more. Step 5, time to review and submit. How nice of eBay to review my listing and make suggestions. I'll pass. Here's a chance to make any corrections to your listing. And here's where you review the fees that have accumulated before the auction starts. If everything's okay, then click continue and let the auction begin. Well, at this point, Margaret was going to start writing up what to do after the auction ends, but she went to eBay and found that they had very succinct descriptions on which she didn't think she could improve. The first part of the link she provided is how to set up the auction, but I'm glad we have her tutorial because it gives the real-world view of what you should care about, warnings about fees, and what kinds of things you should ignore. I appreciate her personal touch to that. In any case, let me read you what eBay says about what to do after the auction ends, starting at section 4 on the eBay link in the show notes. When your listing ends, communicate with your buyer. If you use eBay's checkout service, when your buyer completes checkout, eBay will notify you by mail. If you didn't specify shipping and payment details, The buyer can use checkout to request this information. You can also use checkout to send the buyer an invoice. If you selected not to use checkout, you should contact the buyer directly using email or phone. Important: you should contact the buyer directly if you have not heard from the buyer or the buyer has not completed checkout within 3 days of your listing's end. Receive payment. They make that sound easy. If the buyer paid with PayPal, you will receive an email confirming payment. If you have not yet registered for the PayPal service, you'll be prompted to register to accept the payment. Now it's time to ship the item to the buyer. Pack it up well. Use bubble wrap or crumpled up newspaper to protect the item from damage during shipping. Make sure any parts of the item that are fragile are well padded and located toward the center of the box if possible. I never thought about putting fragile stuff at the center. You don't want to damage from shipping to create problems for you and the buyer. Most important, leave the buyer feedback. eBay's feedback system helps create a trustworthy community for everyone. Your feedback about your buyer is as important for other sellers as their feedback on you is. Well, that's it for this week's tutorial, and I really have to thank Margaret for doing all this work for us. She really did take a lot of time with all the screen snapshots and personal directions. We'll see if I get my nerve up to sell something now. I'll be sure to use her tutorial if I do. Listener Bart wrote in with some answers for me on something I was talking about. I was talking last week about OpenOffice, which is the free version of Office products that runs under X11 on the Mac, and I was complaining about how long it takes to load. And I said, you know, that X11 thing is horrible because it just takes forever, and I didn't understand what X11 was anyway. Here's what Bart wrote to us. You mentioned X11 and not knowing what it was and being slow to load. X11 is the Linux and Unix window manager. It's basically the software that lets Linux applications which have GUIs render their GUIs to your desktop. Linux without X11 is command line only. If you have X11, you can get Linux GUI support. Apple X11 allows Linux GUI applications to run on the Mac. Had Apple not added X11 to OS X, I'd probably still be running Linux on all my machines. X11 has brought Linux applications to the Mac. X11 itself is exceptionally small and very fast to load. It's OpenOffice that is painfully slow to load, not X11. As a quick and not so scientific test, X11 starts up in about 3 seconds on my old G4 Mac Mini. If you're interested, I regularly use X11 for the following applications in order of use. Number one, the GIMP, a great cross-platform Linux, Unix, Mac, and Windows open source graphics package. We're talking Photoshop level power, but with a slightly less intuitive interface, unfortunately. Number two, KSTARS, a great open source astronomy package that I'd be totally lost without. Number three, GNU Cache, an open source accounts package that I use for the account for my small web services company. Well, I think it's pretty funny that Bart says he'd be lost without an astronomy package. I mean, does he use it to triangulate his location every day? Anyway, Bart did inspire me to check some of this out and see if he was telling the truth and X11 was as good as he said. Well, years and years ago, I tried the application GIMP, the Photoshop alternative, but I decided to give it another try. If you've wanted to get Photoshop but couldn't swing the $600, or even the $80 for Photoshop Elements, or maybe you need a good image tool for one of your kids' machines, and like the sound of free, you're really gonna like the GIMP. Plus, it's got a cool name. Before you can load any of these applications, you must install X11, which is not part of the standard install. This part threw me for a loop, so I'll tell you what not to do on the Macintosh. I have the install disk that came with my MacBook Pro, and I also have the official Tiger disks. I installed X11 first from the Tiger disks, and it would not run. I checked the console logs. Those are the logs that you can look at to show you everything that's going on under the hood when you're running an application, and the errors seemed to be talking about my font server running. I remember 10 years ago when I first heard of X, and they were always yapping about fonts. Fonts are always crashing. Fonts aren't working. Still don't understand why everybody cares so much about it. But after about an hour of trying to figure out how to fix this, searching message boards, I found the solution on the Apple message boards. At least for the MacBook Pros, it turns out you have to use the original disk, not the Tiger disk. The Tiger disk must have a bug in it of some sort for X11. All right, now let's get going. To find the installer for X11 is a little bit tricky. It's hidden on the disk in System, Installation, and then Packages. In there, you'll find x11user.pkg. Double-click that, and it'll install X11 for you. I hate to admit it, but it turns out that Bart was right. X11 launches very quickly. I've been disparaging its good name all these years, and for that I'm deeply sorry. All right, time to get GIMP. GIMP is available from gimp.org/downloads. Because open source software is geek heaven, it's a little tricky to figure out which link to click for the download. If you're not an uber geek, scroll down to the link that says Binaries for Various Platforms. At the top, they have all these files where you're going to get like 300 files and you have to compile them and all this crazy stuff. So once you've found Binaries for Various Platforms, click on the GIMP for Unix, including Linux, or Windows, or Mac OS X. To install GIMP on Windows, you're going to need GTK+2 Runtime Environment, which is a multi-platform toolkit for creating graphical user interfaces. I think that phrase means it's the same functionality that X11 brings to Linux and OS X. There's a link on that download page I gave you for an automated installer for both the GIMP and GTK+. Let's head back to Macintosh for a while. I installed GIMP on OS X, and it asked a few odd questions like how much RAM to allocate to the application, which is important in an image editor because if you open something huge, you could end up running out of RAM and the application will use the hard disk for space, which is really slow. That's called swapping to disk. You never want to swap to disk if you can help it. Well, I was confused by this as an option because that concern was eliminated in OS X when dynamic memory allocation was instituted. Basically, in OS X, applications just go get as much memory as they need until they run out and some other application's hogging it. So it was kind of weird that that was in there, but whatever. I went ahead and left it with the default of 128 meg, and I also left all the other defaults alone as it did the installer. GIMP installed just fine, and I've got to say, it's come a really long way since I last looked at it. I put a few screenshots in the show notes so you can see how pretty it is. As I describe the GIMP, remember that my frame of reference is Photoshop Elements, not Photoshop. The tool palette has a whole bunch of tools, way more than elements. Another thing is, I've always been jealous about real Photoshop having a functionality called channels. Channels are a way of separating the three primary colors, red, green, and blue, and operating on a photo in those three independent colors. I'm not sure I actually need that functionality, but I frequently hear or read tutorials on Photoshop where I don't get to play along because Photoshop Elements doesn't have channels. Could be fun using GIMP. I can find a few of the familiar functions, but some of the more standard stuff was still eluding me. It took me a while to figure out how to crop a photo to a fixed aspect ratio like 4:6, but it turned out it was right there in front of me. When I clicked the rectangular marquee, down on the bottom half of the tool palette, a bunch of options had shown up about whether to feather the selection, whether I wanted to add the current selection or subtract, and also the option to crop to a specific size or fixed aspect ratio. I'm used to on Photoshop Elements where that kind of information is up on the top in the menu bar, so it's just a matter of like paying attention to actually find the stuff you need. One of the downsides to Photoshop Elements is that it takes forever to launch. I'm not kidding, this is not like my previous complaints about other applications, but a big frustration for me is that I double-click on a JPEG file in the Finder, and I expect the preview to launch, but instead Photoshop Elements launches, and I just have to go do something else while it comes up. I mean, I go play a game or get a cup of coffee or something, because it takes forever. If Photoshop Elements hasn't been opened recently so that it's cached, I timed it. It took 55 seconds to launch and open a JPEG on my MacBook Pro. It's also not a universal application yet, meaning it's not compiled for the Intel processor, so it has to use the Rosetta emulation. But there is no other application that I run that takes anywhere near as long to launch under Rosetta. I tested it and reopened it after it was cached, and it was way down to 23 seconds, which is still way too long. In contrast, the GIMP, even having to open the much maligned X11 layer, only took 8 seconds to open. I'm starting to think I may switch to the GIMP and stop buying Photoshop Elements. I've bought every upgrade so far. I know I don't want to use it too much until it's universal, which isn't expected until sometime in 2007. The GIMP is universal today, no waiting. One thing I should tell you about the Mac version is that you have to use the Control key, just like on a PC, instead of the Command key we're used to. So for example, instead of Command S to save, it's Control S. This wouldn't be too much of a hassle, shouldn't be too much of a hassle, because most of us use Macs and we also use PCs, so we can switch back and forth just fine, but it is something to remember when you first use the GIMP. Another oddity is that each of the menu and palettes are separate floating windows. That means that they don't all jump forward or back as you switch to the GIMP and back. It's a little disconcerting because while you can see your image, all your palettes could be buried beneath browser windows on the Mac. On the plus side, I know there have been numerous times when I just want the image from Photoshop Elements in front, but I need to see other applications windows right next to it, but Photoshop Elements keeps plopping all of its palettes up on top. So this difference in the GIMP could be useful once I get used to it. I haven't figured out how to print yet. I took an image and cropped it to 4x6. I went to Page Setup to select paper size and get rid of the borders, and then I told it to print, and it showed me the printer I wanted, and I hit print, but nothing ever happened. The print monitor application didn't launch. I tried this a couple of times, then I switched over to Preview to open the edited file, and I was able to print from there. And when I looked, there was nothing stuck in the queue. I'll have to fiddle this with a bit to figure out what's wrong. Printing is a fairly important feature, but not really as important as it once was. I'm wondering whether I need something like Cups Printing, which is also open source. Might need to fool around that. I thought that was already in there. But anyway, I'll be playing with the GIMP for sure, and I think you should give it a whirl too. Hey, it's free, right? I actually used it to edit all of the photos from my son's cross-country meet recently, and the photos that Margaret had given us for the tutorial. I got really, really comfortable with it after a while. Well, call me crazy, but the temptation was just too great. I got an invitation from Microsoft to download and install the first release candidate of Vista. Yes, the operating system that won't even be released into the wild until early next year, in theory, to the general public. What could be more fun than an unreleased operating system installed in a virtual machine on top of OS X? Well, how about having to download and install an unreleased version of Parallels in order to do it? Woohoo! Nothing better than that for major geek fun, I tell ya. I marched on over to the link in the email, and I started the download from Microsoft's website. But the install was so slow. Boy, I sound impatient. I'm always complaining about things being too slow, aren't I? Well, anyway, I figure everybody was hitting that server at once, and I looked at the timer, and it said it was going to take 6 hours to download. So I thought to myself, I'm smarter than that. I should go do it in BitTorrent. That's going to be way faster, right? Well, the cool thing about BitTorrent is that you trade bits around, and this works great and goes really fast as long as a lot of people are sharing and a lot of people have all the bits. Well, that wasn't the case on the very first day that this file was available for Microsoft, so hardly anyone had all of the bits. So it actually took 26 hours to download on BitTorrent. I'm pretty clever, aren't I? Well, once I'd invested a couple of hours in this doing a BitTorrent, I figured I might as well let it run since at least I was helping other people. Once I finally got it downloaded, I loaded up the latest pre-release of Parallels and tried to run the install, and it didn't work. Turns out that version of Parallels worked with the beta version of Vista, but not with Release Candidate 1. The great thing about the Parallels development team is that if something doesn't work, just wait a couple of days and they're going to have a fix for it. Sure enough, Friday morning I went to the site and there was a post for how to run Vista under Parallels Release Candidate 1, and they had a new build that was supposed to work. I launched Parallels, pointed to the ISO image I downloaded of Vista, and I hit play. The Vista installer asked for my license key, which had been provided to me in the invite email from Microsoft. In Parallels, you have to tell the installer upfront how big the installation is allowed to grow to. It doesn't necessarily take that much disk space up front. it's kind of an upper limit. So as you install software and Windows expands as into bloatware all on its own, it has enough space. I originally started by letting Vista have 6 gigabytes, but the installer came back and said, yeah, nice try. I need 6.2 gigabytes. So I rebuilt my virtual machine and gave it 8 gigabytes. Well, I got to the same spot in the installer, and now it says I need 9.7 gigabytes. All right, I just figured that was an errant, goofy thing. I'll just skip that warning and move on. Well, the bad news is that once I got done doing the install, Vista keeps saying I've only got 151 meg left, or danger, danger, Will Robinson, there's not enough space. I went back and I ran the installer's, the Parallels Compactor program, which is really cool. It usually shrinks things up nicely. And after I ran that, I checked the size, and the entire Vista installation was only 5.39 gig out of the 8 gig I'd given it. Figured I should be fine. Well, the really bad news is that even after rebooting Vista, it's still whining about not enough disk space. The good news is that it's running okay when it's not whining about disk space, so I can give some first impressions. I did put a couple of screenshots in the show notes. If you don't believe me that I pulled this off, you can see all the Apple logo stuff all around the Windows installer. When you install a system, an operating system in Parallels, you also have to install what's called the Parallels tools, which are really drivers to fake out the operating system into using the hardware on the Mac. These usually work pretty well, and overall it does work well under Vista. The graphics look good, things move quickly with no traces or anything, and the mouse moves properly and can float between Windows and OS X nicely, but the audio is kind of hinky. This happened in an earlier release of Parallels, so I suspect they'll get it fixed before too long. It's a shame that the audio isn't working, though, because I stumbled across the accessibility section, and I wanted to test out the screen reading capability for our visually impaired listeners to see if it was more advanced than they've had before. Unfortunately, the sound was just too herky-jerky to listen to, I'm afraid. I posted in the Parallels forum about it, so I'm sure someone will fix it shortly or tell me what I boogered up in doing the install. Speaking of graphics, I don't think I'm running the AeroGlass part of it, which is supposed to be the cool, you know, floating, transparent windows and all that. I'm not quite sure how to turn that on or not. I'm not sure how that works, but I'm pretty sure I'm not seeing it. I launched Internet Explorer first in Vista, and I had network connectivity. I'm pretty shocked at how similar things are to XP. I didn't have much trouble navigating around. IE was in the quick launch bar already, and it came up just fine. I put a screen snapshot of Vista with Internet Explorer up, and of course, just as a joke, I had navigated to the Apple homepage for the photo opportunity. You can also see the widgets over on the right-hand side. There's a clock and a photo and some new stuff going on in that picture. Well, the first thing I had to do with IE was download and install Firefox, right? And the install went flawlessly, except for the whining about the disk space part. In IE, when I told it to download Firefox, a screen popped up saying, "Have you seen our really nice new bar up on top that's protecting you in your surfing experience?" Well, I looked up at that bar and it said, "Not downloading Firefox." Wow, that was helpful. I told you to download it. That sure helped me a lot. Oh well, I clicked on that little bar, and there was a pop-up choice to actually run the download. So when I told it to download, it did it. Then when I told it to run the installer, a chime sounded, the entire screen went dim, except for a window warning me that I was about to install software. It's kind of disconcerting, but I guess it gets the job done of not letting software install without us being completely aware of it. At least until someone hacks that, I suppose. I installed Picasa Next, the excellent free photo management tool from Google, and it loaded, but man, the whining about disk space really kicked in then. I might actually be out of disk space, but I'm not sure how to tell whether my disk space is full or not. Picasa ran great as always. One thing that kept me from running Vista too much since I installed it is that it hammers my CPUs. I know I'm always talking about that, but this was nuts. It was regularly hitting up around 80% on both processors. Like I said, Vista has widgets, so I hunted around and I found one that measures systems resources, and it was hanging around 60% on the processor, and only showed one processor, and that is if I was doing absolutely nothing, sitting still, looking at an empty screen, no applications even launched, it was using 60% of the processor. So I wiggled the mouse and it pegged the widget meter at 100%. I let it rest again, went back down to 60 or 70%, wiggled the mouse again, back up to 100. I've mentioned before how nice and toasty my MacBook Pro gets when the processors get cranked, so I haven't been able to run Vista for more than about a half hour before I have to let the poor baby cool down. I'm sure I'll be working more with Vista over the coming months, hopefully getting this disk space issue resolved. I'm sure I'll install Vista quite a few more times, so stay tuned. If there's something you desperately want me to check out on Vista to see if it runs, let me know and I'll try to get it loaded, as long as what you want is either free or there's a free trial. Friday night, we watched the movie Aquila and the Bee. It was a great feel-good movie, and in it they had a wonderful reading from the book A Return to Love by Marianne Williamson. I want to read you this passage as it inspired me to push towards the greatness I know I can achieve, and I hope you'll see that in yourself too. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, and fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small doesn't serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We were born to make our manifest the glory of God that is within us. It is not just some of us, it is in everyone. As we let our own light shine, then we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. With that, go out and be great, do the things you know you can do, don't be afraid. And on that inspirational note, that'll wind up this week's installment of the NoSillaCast. You can email me at allison@podfeet.com or send me a voicemail at nosillacast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.